Welcome to KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland. Today we're going to be speaking about a subject that everybody is affected by and that millions of people are having to choose, rethink, or reimagine: their relationship to work, time, the economy, and each other. It's a topic our guest, Juliet Shore, has been interested in and writing about for a long time. Some of you might remember her from her previous New York Times best-selling book, The Overspent American. Her new book is True Wealth: How and Why Millions of Americans Are Creating a Time-Rich, Ecologically Light, Small-Scale, High-Satisfaction Economy. Welcome, Juliet. Welcome back to KBOO.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Yes, and the same with us. To let our readers know how you come to these ideas and understandings, I want them to know that you are a professor of sociology at Boston College and a former member of the Harvard Economics Department. That's a really nice way to put the two together.
Thanks. So my training is in economics, and I've been in sociology now for 10 years, so I've also learned quite a bit of that field, too.
Yes, and since they are both so intertwined, and as we're seeing now, and people are understanding how really important both are. So if what you're saying about where we are in the books and your ideas are really around these disciplines and concepts, can and might we... how they intersect. Previously, we've spoken with you about your book, Plenitude, which this book has come out of. And so much of what you've been saying is come to pass, but we need the history. So let's start with your research on kind of how we got here.
So I think there are sort of two main pathways that we need to think about. The first is the economic, and before the crash of 2007-08, the country was on a pretty unsustainable path economically, and a couple of big things were going on. I mean, some of them we've heard a lot about, for example, the increasing concentration of wealth. And in the last year before the crash, 1% of the population got all the gains in income and wealth relative to the other 99%. Earlier, it had been more of a story about the top 20% versus the bottom 80%. But in any case, growing inequality, one of the things that does in a country is that it takes away purchasing power from the vast majority of people, and that leads to buildup of credit and debt. And so the banking system facilitated that, but we got increasingly indebted as a population and also as a country, with more and more imbalance in our trade accounts, importing lots and lots of cheap consumer goods from China and not earning currency back by selling goods to them. So we got a rising debt as a country externally relative to other countries. And you had a period in which businesses were increasingly disinvesting from the U.S. economy, particularly in manufacturing, but more and more economic activity going abroad. And when you stop investing and you just start consuming as a nation, that impoverishes you over the long run. And that's part of the harvest that we're reaping now. The talk about the federal deficit and so forth is really, I think, obscuring looking at the much deeper problems of our economy. The other part of this that the book looks at in more depth is what was happening to our, you can think of it as our time balances, and I use the term time wealth as one of the forms of true wealth that we really need to be getting back to. But part of that growing inequality was that it led increasingly to people working longer and longer hours, to businesses demanding longer and longer hours from their employees. And so you get an impoverishment of other parts of our society, family, community, which rely on people having time to participate in them and not spending so much time in their paying jobs. Households having to devote two adults full time and increasingly with long hours to make ends meet. So that's the economic path that we were on. Parallel to that was a trajectory of ecological destabilization, because we've got a very highly polluting, dirty energy system that's creating climate destabilization. We have a global economy that's deforesting in the richest tropical forests of the world.
Yeah, because
overfishing the oceans,
right,
and so forth. So we've got what we call ecological overshoot goes along with the economy that we constructed that also was, you know, faltering in human terms.
Yeah, the extraction and transformation of resources like fuel, wood, sand, all of that. You talk about material economics. Can you explain that a little bit? That's kind of what you were talking about, the material flow.
Absolutely. In standard economics, economists are looking at dollar values of things. And this turns out to be a big problem when you are not using your resources sustainably. So it looked like the economy is growing and growing, but one of the things that it was doing was using up resources at an increasing rate. And I have some new data in the book, which is really important data, which looks at the total material flows. I look both at the U.S. but also the global economy. How much material, how much wood and fossil fuels and biomass and so forth, earth, are we using to produce our standard of living? Economists kept telling us, that we were going to dematerialize, that technological progress was going to make it such that we could keep growing and we'd get more and more efficient in our use of natural resources. And it turns out that that's hardly happening at all, and that the total amounts of materials we're using on a global scale have been rising. And last year, in fact, this is something, some data that just came out, the energy intensity of the global economy even went up. It's getting each dollar of economic value is getting less energy efficient rather than more. So the ways that the conventional discourse has said, don't worry, growth is going to help us solve our economic or ecological problems, and I have a lot in the book about that, about why economists say that growth is not the problem, is not a problem for the environment, but is the solution. It's a kind of counterintuitive, I think, to most of us. Why that's wrong, and really how intense the material demands we are putting on the planet are, and how we could actually start to move to a way of life that is much less materially and ecologically intensive.
And one of the hidden costs that you bring out in the book are that the troubling trend of recent years is that wealthy countries have been offloading a good portion of this burden. And you talk about Chinese factories, for example, are fired by coal, an extremely dirty fuel, with an outsized impact on the climate. And just because we in the Western or the United States are offloading that, it almost hides it from being addressed.
Absolutely. Europe, for example, was patting itself on the back for meeting some of the countries which actually met the first Kyoto targets. But it turned out that in the UK, for example, once they accounted for all the carbon that they were emitting from the products they were buying outside their borders, their emissions hadn't actually gone down. So it is really important to think about these things in a global sense. And the U.S. particularly, because we've had such a big trade deficit, because we've had such a rapid globalization of our economy in recent years, has been offloading a lot of its ecological impact to other places.
So let's talk a little bit about the subject of growth and the reframing of the question, and maybe about the human footprint. I know you were talking about water is going to be to the 21st century what oil was to the 20th.
Yeah, because We already have pretty serious shortages of water around the world, large numbers of people living with water stress of various levels, and now there's a whole kind of science of measuring water stress. But we're actually facing in many parts of the world some very, very scary scenarios as a result of climate destabilization. So pretty much whole areas, the Southeast U.S., for example, which are facing futures of high levels of drought, big declines in rainfall, many other parts of the world, particularly some of the places that are already dry, places like South Asia. I mean, you've got over a billion people who live in India alone, and that whole region relies on, a lot of them rely on water that's coming from the melting glaciers of the Himalayas. Well, with climate change, you have retreating glaciers. So that rainfall, that water source is drying up. So water scarcity is a big part of our future. And I look at the water footprint of the United States, which, as with the carbon footprint, is really so large compared to other places, and we waste such enormous amounts of water in this country, mostly in agriculture, but we also waste it in commercial and residential areas. We waste it in the way we produce industrial products as well.
And mainly, which was highlighted in the book, that we don't actually understand that this is occurring, therefore we don't take really any action that on some levels might be quite at least approachable, if not simple.
Yeah, there is a lot that we can do. But one of the kinds of disconnects that I talk about in the book is the disconnect on the consumer side, because the way consumer culture and the consumer sector has developed, the people who sell products really don't want consumers thinking about things like where they came from, who made them, how much water, or
even
how many other kinds of resources.
Even packaging, even very elemental parts of it.
Right. And because when people become more inquisitive, or some people would say conscientious, mindful, whatever word we want to use about it, they buy less. A big part of why there's so much buying in, you know, sort of really mature consumer cultures is that buying becomes almost just habitual. It becomes like something that you do without thinking it through too deeply. And so that there's that information disconnect, and you have to work really hard, as you know, many people, particularly in recent years, have been trying to find these things out, and they know you have to work really hard in many cases to find out much about these products. So that's one of the reasons we're very disconnected. As production became globalized, we became spatially disconnected. So if you live next to the factory, you might see some of these things. You might know people who work in those factories, etc. If those factories are 3,000 or 6,000 miles away, it's so much harder to know about what's going on.
Absolutely. Well, we want to talk a little bit more about the miracles of the market. But before we go further, I want to remind our listeners we are speaking with author Juliet Shore about her new book, True Wealth: How and Why Millions of Americans Are Creating a Time-Rich, Ecologically Light, Small-Scale, High Satisfaction Economy. Well, now we can talk a little bit about the markets. And if your primary activity gives you pleasure, this approach should help you find more or protect what you have, the one life living. Can you explain that?
Yeah. So this is a book about, it's not mostly about the problems we face. We've talked quite a bit
yes.
about that. It's hard not to these days, especially right now. But it's actually in many ways a guidebook for people to move into a different kind of lifestyle, and gives lots of examples of people who are doing it, and also why it'll work on a large scale. At the beginning of the chapter where I go into depth on kind of what I call the plenitude model and the different steps and the different sources of wealth that people can tap into and invest in and develop in their lives, I say that ultimately, you know, no personal finance program or no, you know, how-to guide about lifestyle can really solve the big questions that you have about that people have about their lives, like, you know, what really matters to them and what is the kind of work that they want to do. Those are questions that are really not economic in nature. But if you have figured those things out, you know, if you have an occupation that you care about, or you have meaning in life, or there are ways that you spend your time that really matter to you, and so forth, what this program can do is help you to be able to do that more, to give you a lifestyle that should free up your time, make it easier to live without having to spend lots and lots of money, but to get access to your goods and services more cheaply, to have more creativity in your life, maybe to help you learn some new skills and incubate a new business or a new career for yourselves. And that's what many people who are living these plenitude lifestyles have started to do. So it can't give you meaning, but it can help you to achieve the things that are already meaningful for you.
And help amplify where those might be found and why they're meaningful, as opposed to that vacuousness that a lot of people have been feeling.
Right.
And remain kind of trapped in how much. And you say it's not about how much, but about what. What kind of energy system, what kind of transportation, what kind of where the investment dollars go, and, you know, where you spend your money, and all of those bigger sociological issues.
Right. And, you know, in this country, the national conversation has all just been about how much instead of what. And it's also a good point for the individual. I mean, if you look at, you know, the whole industry of people who are out there to tell you, you know, what to do, how to manage your money or this and that, and that's all also mostly just about how much. And I think we really have to ask those questions about what is true wealth. And that's why I retitled the book True Wealth from Plenitude, because the big message of the book is that we're a society who's been focusing on one kind of wealth, financial wealth, but time wealth, wealth in our planet and ecosystems, and wealth in our creative activity, and wealth in each other, social wealth. Those are really durable forms of wealth. They're really important. We saw $50 trillion of paper wealth disappear overnight with the financial collapse. $50 trillion. I mean, that's an enormous amount of money. And we're seeing another big chunk of paper wealth disappear as the stock market, you know, has been collapsing over the last few months. The kinds of wealth I'm talking about can't disappear overnight. They're real. They're not paper. And as we face, you know, what I believe is going to be a tough economy going forward over the next decade or so, and as our climate system gets destabilized and our ecological conditions deteriorate, we are going to need those forms of wealth that actually last, that are there in tough times, that help us to be resilient. So that means learning more about creating a local food system, more denser ties socially in a local and regional area, time outside the market so we can learn to do things and to do for each other, learn new skills, learn new forms of being creative. Those are the kinds of things I'm talking about that we're going to need going forward into, I think, what is going to be a dark couple of decades.
Or at least a very, very challenging. And so if what you're saying about where we are is true, then the intelligent response is to begin the transitioning and the shifting towards something new. And that's kind of what the book is set up to do.
Absolutely. One of the big messages of the book is that the mainstream told us over the last 50 years, specialize, specialize, specialize. So, you know, more and more into the market, do one thing and do it well and buy everything else, you know, earn your money with it and purchase all your services and so forth. And we've been going very much in that direction, more and more market, less and less diversified production. This book says diversify because any one source of income is going to be more unstable. Certainly, the job, which is the primary source of income for the vast majority of people in this country, outside of the folks who have retired, your job is more uncertain. You're more likely to be laid off from it. The next job you get is more likely to be short. I mean, all the data are showing that. And you're going to earn less money from it. So it's a less good bet to put all of your eggs in that basket. And what this plenitude lifestyle is about is, in part, diversifying, learning how to meet your needs in a variety of ways, including a job. That's one part of it. But also learning how to procure goods and services partly through maybe you're bartering, maybe you're on a sharing, you know, maybe you're sharing appliances with, you know, lawnmowers and snowblowers with people. Maybe you're doing ride sharing. Maybe you're doing couch surfing. Maybe you're trading used clothes with other families that have, you know, kids with ages that match up with yours, or whatever it is. There's a lot of innovation going on, which is allowing people to meet their consumer needs in ways that are have much less ecological impact and are much, much cheaper. And much more socially connected. Absolutely.
Exactly. Well, I'm wondering how you feel and what's your response to what's happening in the streets today, both in New York and now. Is this kind of a predictable response to some of what's been occurring?
Well, I suppose the you know, surprising thing is that it's taken this long.
Exactly.
but I think it's fantastic. I'm actually going to be in New York later in the week and plan to go down to the protests. They're growing. We've got one going on in Boston now that a number of my students have been involved in, and I think it's really good that there is an energy comparable to what we saw, you know, on the right now starting to emerge on the left. And I think the right and the left here share something, which is we both understand the system's pretty rotten, the system's pretty broken.
It doesn't work for most people.
It's really unfair. It's great to see people getting active and just telling it like it is.
Yeah, well, it's very interesting because in reading your book and in, looking at the landscape, I know one of the criticisms from people who want to have short, succinct answers to very nuanced, difficult, deep questions was, well, what do they want? And it did remind me upon reading your book and several other authors who have kind of tried to say this is the intersection of a lot of different social and ecological and economic issues, not one specific thing. It is about building a new way to be in the world that is both sustainable, hopefully, and that makes more sense.
Absolutely. It is about building a new way to be in the world and about a new system. A majority of young people in this country do not think capitalism is a better system than socialism, and they're right.
It's hard when they are directly affected by the choices that we've made in the past to try and say that this is working. To, you know, especially the people under 30, under, you know. But again, it isn't working well for really almost anyone.
That's right. It absolutely, you know, isn't. And I think that there's, you know, people have been, you know, in a sense, sitting back and hoping that elites who've been running the show for a long time would get their acts together and, you know, lead us out of this mess into something that's going to work. And part of what's so, what people are so angry about is how dysfunctional the elites have become. I mean, the congressional dysfunction is only it's the poster child, but it's a much broader dysfunction across elites. And when that happens, people begin to lose faith and they say, well, we can't trust these folks anymore. They don't know what they're doing.
And more of that even if we did, they don't know what they're doing because, again, we're in a state of transition. Like you say, we know the cost of everything and the value of nothing. And if this were working well for the people, there wouldn't be this feeling of vacuousness and emptiness and lack of satisfaction and sitting in traffic for 45 minutes to get to a job that you aren't sure that you could get again if you wanted to, or that it will be there in the end for you. I mean, there's just a whole lot. Like I said, it's very interesting in your book because you bring those two really important disciplines together of sociology and economics.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I tell you, it is a exciting, if that's the right word, challenging time to be on the forefront of this. And the transition, like I said, is something that is coming our way. Change is inevitable. And in some ways, I think of many people, especially in the economic realm, have wondered how long it would take and feeling like it's kind of overdue.
Yeah, yeah. So it is. The book is very upbeat and optimistic.
It is.
Despite all the, you know, difficult things that are happening. And I've been so gratified by the response to it and the extent to which the kinds of things it's talking about, the movement that it's chronicling are
supporting,
really expanding and growing and becoming more and more legitimate day by day. So.
And I think that's the evidence that we're seeing in the street. Is it, you know, aside from the anger at the way things are, there is a sense of communion and possibility and willingness to try and change.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's very, very highlighted in your book. Again, I want to thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and your book with us today. The book is True Wealth, How and Why Millions of Americans Are Creating a Time-Rich, Ecologically Light, Small-Scale, High-Satisfaction Economy. And if it's about joining together to meet these challenging times, here's a good place to start. Thank you again, Juliet. It's been a pleasure to have you with us today, and good luck.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here. And if folks want to look at there's a wonderful little 4-minute visualization of the book, a little animated version of the book on my website at julietteschor, JulietteschorJulietSchor.org, where you can also find excerpts and other stuff about the book. But the visualization is a lot of fun.
Oh, thanks so much for sharing that piece of information. This is KBOO. It's been a pleasure to have you with us. This is KBOO 90.7 FM, your community radio station, bringing you questions, ideas, and dialogue that's important for your life. So please join us and become one of these voices. Thanks again.
Thank you. So long.
Bye.